everyone, welcome to EHS, this week's podcast for the week ending July the 25th. I'm Nicolita Kuna.
And I'm Allison Branke.
And we're bringing you the latest stories in environment, health, and safety. So Allison, I think you're going to start off with a story about depression and stress in the workplace.
Yeah, so there's a lot of research that is suggesting that the hyper-competitive global economy that we currently work in is taking a really negative toll on employees. EHS Today released a story this week about depression and stress in the workplace, and the author of one report on this topic has dubbed it the elephant in the boardroom. The idea is that workers are being consistently pushed to work longer days, respond to emails after hours, and take fewer vacations, for example. It's expected that this is what people and companies need to do in order to get ahead and stay ahead. However, this can have a lot of negative side effects. So workers can become disengaged if they feel like whatever they do, you know, it's never enough. And stress and depression often result in employees becoming less productive. Ironic, since it's that relentless push to increase productivity and profitability that ultimately ends up decreasing productivity and profits. Of course, it doesn't help that people face a stigma with mental health issues and many don't seek help. Some research even shows that around 86% of afflicted workers would rather suffer in silence. So the cost to employers is quite high, according to one study recently published by the Journal of the American Medical Association. According to this study, depressed workers experience far more health-related productivity losses than those without depression, which costs employers an estimated $44 billion. Another big part of the problem is something called presenteeism. So unlike absenteeism, your workers are physically present at work, but they're not engaged or fully functioning. So again, this makes the issue even less visible. Some tips for employers or managers who are looking to help depressed employees include being aware of what the signs of depression look like. So changes in temperament are a big indicator that something might be wrong. For example, you know, that employee who usually makes friendly conversation might appear more withdrawn, or now they go straight to and from their desk in the morning and at the end of the night. Managers and team members should also be taught to ask, "Are you okay?" and try to build trust and compassion within their teams, you know, is an important part of addressing this problem. Providing ways for employees to get exercise can also be a fantastic way to tackle stress and depression in the workplace. So especially because one of the most common symptoms of depression is fatigue, an overactive mind, and an underactive body. Even just a 30-minute brisk walk can improve your mood over the following 12 hours. According to Graham Cohen, who's a former senior executive at Johnson & Johnson and a survivor of depression, as well as the author of the report I mentioned earlier, The Elephant in the Boardroom, Getting Mentally Fit for Work, employees with a positive attitude are 31% more productive, sell 37% more, and are 300% more creative. So the benefits to instituting some kind of a company program that helps build employee mental well-being are real.
That's definitely something for companies to consider when they're implementing new health and well-being policies in their
workplace. Absolutely, yeah. We've been talking about that too, I think, over the past couple of podcasts, that there really is a growing movement in workplace wellness programs. So it's just another indicator that this is something that, you know, workplaces can really benefit from.
Moving from health to safety, I have an interesting story on emergency shower safety. There can be a serious risk of emergencies in workplaces across a range of industries, especially involving chemicals, gases, and other hazardous materials, which all pose dangerous threats to life, limbs, eyes, skin, and other body parts. According to the Center for Disease and Prevention, 2,000 U.S. workers per day have a job-related eye injury that requires medical treatment. Eye injuries alone add up to more than $300 million per year in lost production time, medical expenses, and worker compensation. So every workplace requires an emergency plan and the correct types of safety shower equipment ready for immediate use. For optimization, safety companies should continuously review the following. So first, companies should complete an emergency response job site assessment. So taking into consideration factors such as product location, water supply, water temperature, accessibility, and equipment identification. Second, companies should review the types of fixtures that they have. So identify potential hazards and then select equipment based on their needs. So for example, do you need emergency eye wash stations or emergency eye and face wash stations or drench showers? Next, think about placement. During a walkthrough, a safety advisor should be consulted in locating fixtures correctly to make sure that all workers are protected. It's also important to reference the Z358.1 emergency equipment standard. Companies should also take into consideration the new generation of emergency fixtures. So there's a lot of improvements made in emergency equipment, and can any of these new fixtures help you in emergency situations? And finally, expert input is always a good idea. So having a third party's perspective on the equipment that you use and your policy can help to improve the safety in your workplace. So you can find the full article in our resources section of this podcast for more on this topic. Allison, I think you have an interesting story from the DOT.
Yeah, so this week on July 23rd, the Department of Transportation released new proposed rules for crewed by rail transportation. They're proposing phasing out thousands of older tank cars within the next 2 years as part of a plan to reduce the risk associated with transporting crude oil by rail. Some other aspects of this new proposal include requiring improved braking systems, tighter speed limits, and thicker tanker walls. Reactions seem to suggest that this is an aggressive timeline, but that it's manageable. If recent incidents across North America are any indication, this rule is also necessary to prevent future tragedies.
The train that derailed in Quebec, Canada last summer is one example.
Yeah, it is. So this new rule from the DOT is prompted by a number of major accidents in the U.S. and Canada in recent years. These old safety standards were developed before the shale oil boom, and at that time, oil was rarely moved by rail. However, analysts are suggesting that the new safety rules could have a negative impact on bottom lines across many industries in the U.S. and could complicate around 10% of shipments of domestic crude to refineries.
Did the DOT have anything to say about the cost of complying with this proposal?
Yeah, so the department did also acknowledge this week that there will, of course, be an associated cost. And they mentioned that some estimates put the cost as high as $6 billion over the next 20 years. However, benefits and accidents avoided could be as high as $4.75 billion. One pretty incredible statistic that's being mentioned in this debate, since May 2011, the North Dakota and Texas oil production boom has increased the amount of trains in the U.S. by more than 400%. That being said, oil by rail shipments have been declining this year, with many companies now favoring oil exports by pipeline. However, these projects have also had some pretty rough going in the form of legal challenges, public perception, and opposition from environmental groups. So the Keystone XL pipeline is, I think, the example that most of our listeners would be aware of. So this U.S. proposal is subject to 60 days of public comment, and you can find more information about this in the resources section of our podcast. Nicola, I think you also have a story about safety and transportation.
Yes, so there's a new proposal that would change federal hazardous material regulations and allow the transportation of certain explosives, ammonium nitrates, and other hazardous materials in bulk that are not currently authorized under regulations. So proposed by the Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Administration, PHMSA, operators of trucks with good safety records would receive reduced regulations when transporting explosives. So with the current rules, trucks that transport these materials have to annually apply for special permits. But the proposal is intended to reduce the paperwork by eliminating renewal requests and could save the transportation industry more than $16 million each year. The proposed rule comes in response to two petitions, one from a transportation company and another from an explosives manufacturing group, both requesting the elimination of the special permits and the incorporation of a voluntary consensus standard into the HMR to develop bulk explosive requirements. So comments on the proposed rule are due September 15th, if you're interested in commenting on that.
In more international news, I have a story about young factory workers in China. So there have been some disturbing reports recently about a surge in the number of healthy young workers in China dying in their sleep. In fact, hundreds of young men living in the manufacturing area of Dongguan have died from unexplained nocturnal death syndrome over recent years. The paper, released by researchers at Sun Yat-sen University, found that there were 893 cases of nocturnal sudden death syndrome in the area between 2001 and 2013. In comparison, between January 1990 and December 1999, there were just 231 cases. So unexplained nocturnal sudden death is said to have occurred when a healthy individual dies in their sleep and the autopsy shows no sign of fatal disease or injury. These people usually experience difficulty breathing just before their death. The researchers analyzed police records of deaths in the area over the last 20 years and found that over 90% of the victims were factory workers. Dongguan is also known as the factory of the world and is a major production base. So the city produces construction goods, chemicals, electronics, home appliances, metal, furniture, garments, shoes, and toys. In fact, 93% of the victims were male, with most aged between 21 and 40. So this is a relatively unexplained phenomenon right now. But the most prevalent theory at the moment is that it may be related to extreme conditions and excessive overtime. Bosses in the area typically pay very very low salaries, but pay is much higher for overtime work. This encourages people to apply for and work significant overtime hours. The director of a migrant worker center in the area told the South China Morning Post that workers' rights groups have been worried about these sudden deaths for many years. He's one of many to point the finger at long working hours, but also mentions poor sanitation and ventilation. Apparently, it's also very hard for the victims to receive any sort of compensation, since the concept of overwork isn't recognized by Chinese law. However, many workers would not be able to earn enough to live if they refused to work overtime. So the Department of Labor in Dongguan refused to comment earlier this week, but hopefully this research will raise some awareness around these working conditions and prevent future deaths from occurring.
I hope they do some more research to provide some insight into this, because it's quite frightening.
Absolutely, right? I think you hope that this is just the starting point and that we do get a little bit more information and some more answers about, you know, what's going on here.
Moving to the construction industry. As we know, falls the number one cause of fatalities, 269 out of the 775 construction fatalities in 2012. And fall prevention in construction is OSHA's most frequently cited safety violation. So a recent publication from the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH, focuses on this issue and is looking to help prevent falls by including safety features into building and worksite design. So the new publication, Preventing Falls from Heights Through the Design of Embedded Safety Features, urges building designers, construction employers, and safety professionals to consider the need to protect construction workers, future facility occupants, and repair and maintenance workers from fall hazards from the earliest stages of building design. So according to this idea, permanent fall protection features can be integrated into buildings, reducing or eliminating the need for less effective temporary measures. According to NIOSH, the recommended hierarchy of controls for fall protection is, first, eliminate or modify the fall hazard. So either adopting a building design involving a single level at grade rather than multiple levers at elevations, or by using parapet walls, permanent guardrails, and other features to separate workers from fall hazard. Second, provide a fall restraint system. This means securing the worker at an anchor point, connector, lanyard, and body harnesses to prevent the worker from reaching the fall hazard. And third, install a fall arrest system. So this means using an anchor point, connectors, lanyards, and body harnesses, but it allows exposure to the fall hazard and is designed to stop a fall after it has begun. So other recommendations NIOSH has for incorporating fall prevention strategies into building design include, during renovations or new construction, perform safety design reviews to identify tasks that could involve fall hazards, install permanent fall protection features. Many commercial and professional buildings can embed permanent equipment into steel or concrete parts of a building that can be used to set up fall protection systems. So these features can prevent falls during construction as well as during building maintenance after construction. So great examples include concrete straps, anchor points, and guardrail support. The NIOSH publication, it really emphasizes that architects and building engineers don't always consider fall hazards during the early design of a construction project. But embedded fall safety features can really save money, and fall protection is more efficient with permanently installed features rather than installing temporary fall protection each time. So for more information on that publication, you can find the link in our resources section below. And I think that's it for the week. We hope you enjoyed this week's stories, and we'll talk to you next week.
Have a safe week, everyone.